Hey, everybody, welcome back. Thanks for joining us today as we continue through the early part of Genesis and as we move into a new, not only a new chapter literally, but also a new chapter figuratively in the story as we join the man and woman, Adam and Eve, now known in the text consistently, outside of the garden. And as they come into this new reality, we really jump right to the story. So there are connectors. Be fruitful and multiply hangs in the background, as does their disobedience. And we see these things come together. So the first thing that we read as we open the chapter, verse 1, chapter 4, "Now the man knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have produced a man with the help of the Lord." Oh, we can just briefly stop there, Michael. So this word "know" in Hebrew is really important in the scripture, and particularly in the book of Genesis. To know someone, obviously there is physical intimacy, even sexual intimacy here, but there is relational intimacy. To know someone is in this context something personal and deep, far more than a friendship, far more than passing. So here it is used synonymously with he makes his wife pregnant. So the man knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have produced man with the help of the Lord. And very interesting that outside the garden, in the punishment which she has just undergone, remember that God told her punishment for the disobedience would be difficulty of childbirth. Having now come through that difficulty, to Eve's credit, she stays relationally grounded in who she is as creature and looks to the Creator, giving thanks, saying, I have brought forth a man with the help of the Lord. So she acknowledges, even outside the garden, even through difficulty, that the Lord has been involved.
Yeah, right. We should, I think, read this positively, that ultimately God has been faithful, even following the consequences of the fall. This is good news. I mean, ultimately, that this thing that was going to be more difficult, childbearing, is still possible, that they can still, on some level, keep this promise that God made, that they would be the people who would carry on, populate the earth, that they would be fruitful and multiply. Here is the first mark of that happening. And there's a sense in which this is the first positive note that's followed all of the negative notes that we've had thus far, that amidst all of the struggle, sacrifice, the shame, the guilt, the vulnerability that the man, the woman have experienced thus far, now there's birth and there's new life and there's the hopefulness that comes with that. And she properly attributes that blessing to the help of the Lord. And so, you know, it is an interesting contrast, of course, in the sin narrative. Both Adam and Eve take what's not theirs from the Lord's own garden, from his own command, the thing that he told them do not do. They chose to take their own action and to take for themselves. Now, as this good thing happens, Eve ascribes praise to the Lord. And that is, I mean, fundamentally, that is a kind of movement of faith. It's a positive thing, certainly, to follow what we've had thus far.
Right. And let me read on a ways, and then there's a lot to talk about here. Next, she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of the sheep and Cain the tiller of the ground. And in the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel, for his part, brought of the firstlings of his flock and their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering, he had no regard. So we'll stop there kind of mid-verse. There is a lot happening here, and we begin to see the introduction of some themes that will be important throughout the rest of Genesis that have to do with siblings, specifically brothers. The brother relationship in the book of Genesis, which is filled with family stories, is one of an adversarial nature, often a kind of competitiveness, a kind of againstness, brother against brother is often the case, particularly as we see here that the younger brother often gets a favored spot or a favored judgment over the older. This is a theme we'll return to a couple of times in this book. We also have the kind of, there's a little bit here, this is more of a cultural story, but remember that the people of Israel, by and large, are agrarian, they're herders. And so there is also, I think we can probably read perhaps a slight bias here in the animal, the raising of animals versus the tilling and of fields and farming. At least some Bible scholars have suggested that there is a very subtle nod given here to a herding lifestyle versus a farming lifestyle. Now, how much you want to put into that, I'll leave that up to you. The obvious question is, why does God prefer one sacrifice over the other? And there is perhaps a very subtle clue in this idea that Abel brought the firstling, but the truth is, be very suspicious of anybody who tells you they know, because the bulk of both Jewish and Christian Bible study has been, we don't really have a clear answer to that question.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We are probably most interested in answering the question, why would God show favoritism? And the author seems far less interested in answering the question, why God chose one sacrifice over the other. The author seems interested in the question, why did Cain respond in such a way to the way that God responds? And we're about to see how distinct of a difference that really is. But what is really interesting, maybe if you're willing to look at it this way, is that here we have both brothers responding to God's gifts, to both responding with thanksgiving, and yet in their response, they are treated differently. And this kind of election is a theme that's going to come up, as you've already stated, Clint. And I think what's telling about it is it already foreshadows, we already, just a few verses into chapter 4, we see that relational hierarchy that we saw happening with Adam and Eve in the consequences of chapter 3, we now see it being lived out in flesh and blood in their offspring. So if you had any sort of positive hope that came from the beginning of this, that, hey, look, a new life is happening, we're turning over a new leaf, we now see that this sinfulness and this breakdown of relationship is actually traveling one generation to the next. It's embedded in the human experience now such that one can't get away from it. And that's really significant, Clint. We come to understand in a text like this that the problem of sin is not by situation, but it is rather intrinsic to the human experience.
Yeah, and it matters that this is a family story. You know, family is often the location of our greatest traits, our deepest wisdom, and our deepest wounds. And so here we begin to see there is, in the backdrop, there is a sort of competitiveness. It's not said in the text that either brother is trying to outdo one another. That may or may not be the case. We have no insight on that. But there is this moment in which God has regard. God has favor for one and not the other. And why? Those are God's reasons. There's no explanation really given, though we can take some guesses in the story, but we have to acknowledge that they are guesses. And while they might be interesting, we ultimately don't know. But Cain here comes in second. The first brother comes in last, and his response is fitting in verse 5. So Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. The word countenance in Hebrew essentially means his face fell. It has to do with being disappointed, being angry. It's what you think. It's a frown. It's to be mad. It's that kind of sense of it. It affected him. His demeanor changed. Anger does that. Anger works. And so this is the first moment where we've really seen anger in the story. And his reaction is not to offer a better sacrifice or to understand, or what he gets angry, and that anger becomes displaced at his brother. And that's probably far enough for today, but it sets the stage for the rest of the story.
Yeah, and that's a hard, that's maybe a hard turn in the story for those of us who experience anger more quickly on that train, right? Because fundamentally, this idea that God shows no regard does not on any level suggest that God has rejected one brother over another. I think sometimes we read more into this story than is actually here. Let's be clear. God does not regard this sacrifice, this offering that has been made. And yet Cain responds to that rejection of the thing with deep-seated personal anger and frustration, that he responds to God as if he had been rejected. And, you know, this is, I think, a temptation for all humans to think that fundamentally we are at stake, and not just God, like a loving parent looking over and trying to lead and to teach. So much time in church history has been spent trying to answer the question, why? Why did God choose this offering over another? And that gets really, really sort of deep into the weeds of people speculating. But if you're willing to rise above that for just a moment, to look down at that with a little bit higher view, isn't it interesting how the first generation that follows, right, the first generation born and not created, that their conflict breaks down their relationship between each other and with God, and it's not fundamentally an issue that God has with Cain per se, but rather with the sacrifice or the offering or the worship that they're giving. They have made this material thing of much greater importance than maybe even God had. We don't know that. The text isn't explicit about that. So we do have questions. I think anyone who comes to this text is going to wonder, why in the world, God, could you be justified in one over the other? But it seems like maybe the author is trying to point us to a far different reality. Why does Cain respond in the way that Cain does? And clearly that's connected to the story that precedes this one.
Right, and I think we have a little time here, so let's press on and see God's response. So Cain was very angry, and the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry and your countenance has fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is lurking at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it." A really fascinating verse. Why are you angry? If you've ever dealt with kids, you have, right? A kid gets mad, flies off, and you say, "Well, why are you angry? I asked you to do something." You know, whatever it is, that overreaction. So you have God, sort of the calming parent here. Why are you angry? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, it doesn't say you won't be accepted, right? That's what you might think, but it says then sin is lurking at the door, trying to master you, trying to own you, but you must master it. So what do we learn in this very short but very interesting verse, right? The theme of the Old Testament. You must do well or you risk sin mastering you. This will be, in summary, the struggle of every family, every individual, and of the nations of Israel and Judah throughout the rest of the text. So we have here not only a response to Cain, we have a framing of the fundamental truth of the Old Testament. Do well or you risk being mastered by sin. You wouldn't necessarily get that reading it, but I think if we put it in conversation with the bigger story, it is clear that this is foreshadowing for us.
Right, and it is an example of a thing that seems much more simple until you dig under the surface and you realize how deep it goes. Because this idea of doing, you know, just offer the right sacrifice, right? Just do the right thing in this instance is not nearly that simple. You know, look at the history of faith that will follow. The doing is complicated by all of this internal intent of the heart. And You know, that's really intensified here by this language. Why are you angry? Why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? That there's this idea here that it's not just the sacrifice. It says you will not be accepted. There is this real sense that we, mindful of our brokenness, mindful of our own sinful motivation, that the simple task of just doing the right thing is far more difficult than just waking up and doing the right thing that day. I mean, it reminds me of Paul and his comment about, I try to do what's right, but I can't, and I'm at war with myself. You know, we have this very sort of image embedded right here in Genesis chapter 4, this narrative where we see Cain struggling with God, struggling with anger about why he has been treated differently and why he believes that that's a sign that he's not accepted. What God says, no, simply do this thing. But of course, we know the end of the story. He's unable to do that thing. He's unable to do it for himself. And that's the depth of the human problem at stake here.
Right. And it's very interesting that God does not accuse him of sin. God says that sin is, and this is a wonderful word, lurking, kind of hiding around the corner, kind of waiting for its opportunity. And that's a very earthy, a kind of negative connotation word. Well, what have we seen in the story that lurks? The serpent, right? The serpent slithers. The serpent kind of sidles up to Eve and offers an opportunity to sin. And so here again, we have some connections with the story, and we have a word to all of us. Sin is lurking at the door. It desires you, and you must master it. And unfortunately, Abel is going to not only not master it, he's going to miss it by a million miles. But we will cover that part of the story tomorrow.
Yeah, the implications of this, let's be very clear about this. The implications of this are not the firstborn just trying to be a perfectionist. The implications of this will be history shaping. It will transform the life of this family and even God's relationship with the first generation of those born after creation, right? The schism that we are already seeing present between Cain and God, and in some ways between Abel and Cain, this relational schism is going to become final and permanent in a way that this story is very foreboding. You can already get the heaviness of this, and we're not even to the heaviest part yet. So thanks for being with us, friends.
Appreciate it, everyone. Have a great day.
We'll see you tomorrow.